All right. The resistance to the Vietnam War was a landmark movement in the 60s and 70s that would come to define the period and was stamped into the minds and lives of those who participated. The stultifying Red Scare, Cold War atmosphere of the 1950s had seemed to smother all the radical tendencies. But this passivity and flatness did not last forever. Hundreds of thousands of people were moved to attend protests and even resist the draft, risking jail time and bashing by the cops at the time. This was the time when high school students were revolting. The Draft Resisters Union was organizing networks of safe houses across the country to defend and protect draft resistors. And the Vietnam War had come to embody had come to be the embodiment of everything wrong with the world. And it was brought to an end in part thanks to the incredible anti-war movements in the US and in Australia. And in this talk, I'm going to explain how these movements came from humble beginnings to the peak, to the moratorium marches that shook the country, and the impacts that the opposition to the Vietnam War had on society and into the future. So to set the scene, Bu Hiss, this was the time of Menzies, and the 50s in general were a time of retreat and defeat for the working class generally. After an uptick in struggle immediately after the end of World War II, the Labor Chifley government had quickly thwarted that, and then Robert Menzies won government in 1949 for the Liberal Country Party coalition, and the Conservatives ruled for the next 23 years. And in government, Menzies strengthened the industrial court that the Labor government had introduced, and punitive fines were levied against unions for strikes. And he was largely successful with his pro-business agenda. Wages fell in Australia for the first few years. The wages share of national income dropped in the first few years of his government. And famously, Menzies also attempted to ban unsuccessfully attempted to ban the Communist Party. So post-war Australia was a bit of beset by some contradictions. It was more prosperous than that of earlier years. This was the time period where workers were often buying their family their first car, but it was beset by serious divisions. There was still poverty, persistent, even if it was mostly unrecognized. And working class struggle had retreated. The kind of really bitter, turbulent interwar and depression years with their like fights against evictions and so on had receded. But this was not to last forever, and all that was solid was about to melt. So the Vietnam War was not the first social movement to bring thousands of people to the streets in the 60s, and there was an emerging counterculture, anti-establishment mood that was sweeping the globe. And it was gaining momentum as the civil rights movement in the US grew and made some gains. And it's kind of easy to downplay the impact of this counterculture, just kind of dismiss it as just some kind of culture rebellion, just people growing their hair out. But society was changing for young people. Bob Dylan was telling us the times are a-changing. Nina Simone was singing about revolution, and they were putting words to a feeling that was in the air. And the hippie lifestyle rebellion had definitely arrived. And just to give a bit of a taste of this, this was the time of high school students leafleting and organizing walkouts against racism, unfair treatment, and the Vietnam War. And just like one little anecdote of this was that in 1969, Inala High School student Margaret Bailey was suspended from school for undermining the authority of her teachers for telling a younger student that teachers can't tell her how long her dress is. And soon a teach-in was organized at UQ. Schools were leafleted. Around 100 people picketed the education department building that was in the CBD. And most dramatically, Bailey herself chained herself inside the Treasury building for 10 hours. And she recalled, "The end result was that I was expelled from all schools in Queensland. Little compared to the fact that I met and began friendships with people who would become and remain important to me and whose friendships constantly reminded me of the importance of a moral and questioned life." Also, the radical scenes from the US were being broadcast around the world. The civil rights movement was hugely influential. And by the 60s, the news was seeping through to Australia about mass meetings, student walkouts, sit-ins, civil disobedience, boycotts and riots. And the scenes of police violence, attack dogs and fire hoses provoked outrage, later mirrored in the gory scenes of napalm burning up Vietnamese villages. And to be a young person in Australia, it must have felt like all the youth of the world were rising up and shouting with one voice. A changing in the universities was also key for laying out the powder to be sparked alight in future campus revolts. After World War II, universities had gutted their arts courses, re-emphasized all of the science and technology courses, expanding them to suit the needs of the post-war capitalist economies, the needs of these economies for more labor, more scientists, more bureaucrats to staff the state departments. And alongside this, the proportion of students in the population was on the rise. This increase in student numbers was happening all over the world, from Western Europe to Latin America and Japan. By 1968, the US had 7 million students, which was one third of the country's youth of uni age. And in Australia, the total enrollment at all unis in 1950 was just over 30,000, but 18 years later, in 1968, it was more than 100,000. And all these changes brought out sharp contradictions. Students, fresh-faced, arriving at their campus, were expecting their universities to be places of inquiry, scholarship, critical thinking, questioning the world. But instead, the campuses were kind of clung to ancient tradition, often had funny rituals, funny costumes. The administrations were authoritarian and censorious, and the classes were crowded and boring. And the Vietnam War kind of broke out into this time of ferment and radicalization, and it couldn't help but be something that set fire to the minds and hearts of a generation. So a bit about the Vietnam War, what it was about. A civil war had begun in Vietnam between the Vietnamese Liberation Front and the US's puppet regime in the South. The US had determined to intervene in mid-1965 with their own troops, not because they wanted to bring democracy to Vietnam, but actually to maintain the US's position at the apex of the world order and to shut down our communist influence across the globe. And by the end of 1965, the US had committed 200,000 troops to the conflict. The Menzies government was very supportive of the US invasion and also committed Australian troops after reintroducing conscription for young men. And from the beginning, the US's strategy was to inflict mass murder and devastation upon Vietnam, hoping that the population would then turn on the NLF and demand that they surrender. Instead, the more that the US, with help from Australia, brutalized the Vietnamese people with chemical weapons and torture, the more they turned to the NLF. So from the outset of the war, there were groups across society who opposed it, like the already existing Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament and church and peace groups, groups established like the group Save Our Sons. But in the beginning, it was very significant that the official Labor Party did too. Under the leadership of Arthur Calwell, who had campaigned against conscription in the 1916 and 1917 referendums, Labor policy was opposition to troops in Vietnam and an end to the war. They still supported the US alliance and they didn't oppose the bombings of Vietnam. But Calwell spoke of spending money on services at home and not overseas. And he was vehemently against conscription. In a speech, just days before the election, Calwell condemned those who wished to plunge their arthritic hands wrist deep in the blood of Australian youth. When Holt won the election in a landslide in 1966, taking on the issue of Vietnam too strongly was blamed, and Calwell was replaced by Gough Whitlam in 1967. And under Gough Whitlam, the ALP swung to the right and fell largely silent on the issue of Vietnam until much later. And this defeat of the ALP demoralized some student activists, but turned some others away from the ALP and towards protest politics. So the first to move into action against the war were the unions that were led by communists, and it was a slower burn on the campuses. The maritime unions in particular were communist strongholds and had already been taking action in the interwar years, like the Port Kembla waterside workers who had refused to load pig iron bound for Japan in 1938. And for his part in attempting to break this boycott, Menzies was branded pig iron bog for the rest of his life. In March 1965, before Menzies announced that Australia would send troops, there were already protests by workers. For example, the Building Workers Industrial Union protested to the government and to the federal union body, the ACTU, about the use of napalm in particular, about the use of chemical weapons, phosphorus bombs by US forces. And a few weeks later, the Sydney branch of the Waterside Workers Federation held up 37 ships in Sydney Harbour by staging a 24-hour strike in protest against the US military involvement in Vietnam. And in April 1965, after Menzies had announced that Australia would send troops, 2,500 members of the Melbourne branch of the WWF, the Waterside Workers, walked off the docks in protest. And here in Queensland, 500 seamen, waterside workers and ships painters went to the US embassy in Brisbane and picketed it. And the Queensland Trades and Labour Council, acting on some prompting by some radical unionists, called for the immediate withdrawal of all foreign troops, including Australian, from Vietnam, and suggested that Australia had sent troops to Vietnam in order to influence the US to remove some of its restrictions on American investment in Australia. So the ACTU quickly made clear its stance at the start in 1965, seeing that, you know, an election was on the horizon. They were being pressured by small but key communist-led unions. And the ACTU executive itself declared itself opposed to the decision to send troops to Australia. But on the other hand, the ACTU president, Albert Monk, declared opposition to stoppages as a protest. And they refused to agree to the communist union's requests to organize industrial action. And the ACTU followed the line of Arthur Calwell, who had announced that while he had opposed the government's decision to send troops, he would never deny aid and support to the troops who had been sent. And despite this moderate stance from the official institutions, anti-war worker militants were not put off. And there's a bunch of like just really cool examples that I can talk about. In May 1966, after the government chartered a merchant ship called the Bunuru to carry stores and equipment to Vietnam, the Seamen's Union decided to decline the proposal to man the ship and work on it. And after disapproval and pressure from other unions, the Seamen's Union relented. But again, in February 1967, the Bunuru tried to load up in Melbourne with bombs to Vietnam. And again, the Seamen Union's workers walked off. And the union's federal secretary, E.V. Elliott, said the government was trying to involve civilian seamen in active service in the Vietnam war zone. The ACTU issued the union with a directive to comply and man the ship, but the union refused. And the dispute was actually settled when the government decided to just acquire the Bunuru for the Navy, just take it out of civilian hands to get rid of the dispute. And it was the first time in Australian history that the Royal Australian Navy had commissioned a merchant ship because of an industrial dispute. The Seamen's Union were isolated at first, but their stance emboldened other workers to express their opposition to the war. As early as January 1967, six unions in Queensland imposed a black ban on all aircraft used by the South Vietnamese Premier, Air Marshal Khai, when he came on a tour around Queensland. And in September, 2,600 waterside workers walked off ships in Sydney in support of a worker who had been suspended for refusing to load bombs onto another merchant ship, the Japaret. And there are historical reasons why it was the maritime unions that were the first to move. Many of them were led by members of the Communist Party at the time, which was something that the government and the media never ceased to red scare about, never ceased to mention. They had history of political actions and international solidarity. but a number of maritime, metal and construction unions had communists in their leadership, and yet they did not take industrial action. So it's not just because it was Communist Party led. The strong internationalist streak in the Seamen's Union was in part a product of rank and file seamen whose views had been shaped by their experiences working on ships that had sailed around the world. And they were in a key strategic position, their role as being the people who loaded things in and off ships at the docks, and they knew it. The union involvement in the anti-war movement here in Australia was much larger than in the USA, and it was crucial. The unions had history, the unions had resources, organisers, journals, papers, the ability to print lots of leaflets. They had some real bread and butter stuff that it's not just possible for student activists to come up with. They had deep roots in communities, and they were able to get the anti-war messages out to thousands of workers who might not have answered the appeals of the student radicals or the churchy peace groups. And nowadays, it is widely known that the Vietnam War movement mobilized hundreds of thousands of people from all walks of life, and it became a truly diverse social movement. But it is important to say that the courageous actions of radical workers and militants preceded the influx of the masses of the young people and the students, and they took a stand against the popular sentiment of the times. For example, when the war broke out, at least half of Labor voters polled supported it. And for the students too, a tiny activist core initiated the demos, initiated the teach-ins, and in the beginning, they were small. In September 1966, a poll in Sydney University's student newspaper, Honi Soa, showed that 68% of students supported sending troops to Vietnam. And a 1968 survey at Flinders University in Adelaide found that only 8% of students opposed the war. But by 1968, the tide was changing, both in the war and at home. For one, heroic Vietnamese resistance was pushing back. In January 1968, the National Liberation Front launched the Tet Offensive, which dealt a psychological blow to the US. Poor farmers and peasants, armed with grenades made out of Coke cans, had delivered significant defeats to the US, an army that had at its disposal more killing power than any military ever seen before in any in the history of the world. And the sense was growing that the war was unwinnable and it was wrong. After the Tet Offensive, the US President, LBJ, came out and said he would stop the bombing of North Vietnam and he would not seek re-election. The first televised war, images of this violence were just beamed into the living rooms of millions of ordinary people across the globe. On the nightly news, there were the horrendous scenes of napalm and Agent Orange. The reality of the situation was plain to see. The West was raining bloody, fiery barbarism down onto the peasants of Vietnam, all in the name of liberty and freedom. Police bashings and disciplinary in universities also hastened the deepening politicization of campuses. It was a radicalizing experience for young people, especially because it was the first time ever that you could be conscripted and then deployed overseas, like literally just like sent into the front lines. Even the most apolitical young people, students and young workers were made to think about conscription, democracy, fairness, the war, whether it was right or wrong. And as a young man doing your degree in Australia, you could be taken into the army, trained to kill, and then dropped into Vietnam. And this was all before you reached the age which you could vote, which was 21 at that time. And when you peacefully protested this, when you joined a peaceful action on your campus or in the streets, cops charged their horses over you. So was this a democracy worth dying for? It was also the case that casualties were mounting. And it just, because of the situation, about half of the dead Australian troops in Vietnam were young conscripts. So the movement against conscription was also growing. And previously, young men refusing to enlist had fought out their battles in the courts, you know, appealing to get conscientious objector status, being jailed, and there being, you know, kind of individual kind of campaigns to free them. But by 1968, the mood had definitely shifted. And the forming of the Draft Resisters Union in early 1968 demonstrates this. This was a group who their aim was not merely to oppose conscription as like a courageous moral stand, but to wreck it. The previous, by now the mood was seriously huge to stop conscription. And an example of this was increasing trade unionists, activity to oppose conscription. There's this example of like 10 trade union officials. This is a leaflet about what had happened to them. They had just tried to stand outside, like an office where people were like registering to join the war and just hand out leaflets saying, don't, do you know what you're dying for? You know, you're signing up to die. And they had been arrested. And these are like organizers with like, you know, key unions across Australia. And it's just like, this is so undemocratic. You can't even hand out a leaflet, about it. And another example of kind of like the general mood, was that in December 1969, there was a meeting in Fitzroy in Melbourne, of 300 shop stewards, which represented 32 unions and over 150,000 workers. And they passed a resolution calling on national servicemen in Vietnam to lay down their arms in mutiny against the heinous barbarism perpetrated in our name upon innocent aged men, women and children. This was a meeting of the some of the trade unionists from the rebel unions, the like breakaway group from the Victorian Trades Hall. And both the Prime Minister Holt and the leader of the Labor Party, Whitlam, condemned this meeting and condemned their motion, along with virtually every other major newspaper and institution. And Bob Hawke, the newly elected leader of the ACTU, quickly distanced himself and the ACTU from this motion. And the incident was a fitting highlight to what had become increasingly apparent over the previous few months, that more and more unions were prepared to adopt a more militant stand on Vietnam than they had previously taken in the past. So far from the Seamen's Union being a bit isolated, going out on their own, by now there was a very mass feeling against the war and against conscription. So in the early 60s, students were overwhelmingly from the middle class or higher, and so an elitist kind of liberalism dominated the politics of students, kind of appealing to the consciences of those in the institutions, taking moral stances. But by the late 60s, the strains of the new left were emerging. The CPA was the largest organization in society to the left of the ALP, but it was it was still Stalinist. It was very conservative. It was kind of obsessed with respectability and, sucking up to their friends in the union leaderships and the ALP. And increasing numbers of newly radicalized students were being attracted to Maoism, anarchism, and revolutionary socialism. Among the student left, the slogan "Bring the War Home" was popularized, and that to defend the Vietnamese revolution, one had to make one's own here at home. And the idea of revolution and socialism on the horizon captured the imagination of a sizable minority. Unfortunately, only tiny numbers of socialists were active on the campus, and no like national revolutionary student or movement meant that the CPA could work on like jazzing up their image, trying to appeal to students and recruit. And the only consistently active anti-Stalinist revolutionary socialists were based on a couple campuses across Australia. In the meantime, the proportion of students participating in activity was sharply on the increase, especially on militant campuses such as Monash, La Trobe, and these hallowed halls of UQ, which was one of the hotbeds of radicalism in this time. And this was an era where nothing was too extreme. As one activist recounted, as I read through different things, he talked about how the political climate had shifted so far to the left that if you were, you know, if you opposed the war and you were collecting funds for medical aid, you were a moderate. And to be a radical, you opposed the war and you were collecting funds to fund arms for the NLF, for them to fight the war and beat back the US troops. So yeah, UHU in particular was a leading campus for activism. It's a bit of a misnomer to say it was like all being led or done by the student union. The student union for most of the time period was largely dominated by conservatives, but it was just kind of bypassed by the radicals who were setting up all their own kind of groups and getting to do what they wanted. And this was the time of the forum, as you can see, when students and radicals would spend hours speechifying, debating, discussing all kinds of radical ideas. This is an area that's just outside the student union complex, which if you are a student here, you just pass through that area every day. And students set up a group called Students for Democratic Action, which was modeled off the US's Students for a Democratic Society. Because the Vietnam protests in particular here in Queensland, they were just spilling over into a civil liberties movement. They were kind of forced to take up the issue of civil liberties and democratic rights, because under the repressive police state of Joe Bjelke-Petersen, who had come in 1968, I believe, he just like started to ban street marches. And even just like peacefully protesting on the footpath, the cops would just attack you. In 1967, up to 4,000 students marched from the St. Lucia campus into Roma Street. And these are some photos, from that day. And 2,000 students staged a sit down outside the police headquarters that are outside in Roma Street for people who've passed by there as well, demanding civil rights. And the cops just brutalized them and arrested something like 114 people. But this violence just didn't cow activists. People were pretty staunch. And in 1970 was another one of the peaks of activism at UHU here. If anybody's ever wandered around the campus here, you'll, on the other side of the football fields, you'll run into like a fenced off area and you'll see some funny signs that tell you that's the UHU regiment. That is literally like a regiment of like officers that come specifically from UQ, and that's just here at this campus. But of course, students in the 60s and 70s didn't take that lying down. And in 1970, students stormed the UQ regiment buildings, they smashed furniture and they threw files out of the window. Yeah, all across Australia, any universities kind of that had these elite regiments attached, a lot of them were just kind of chased off the campuses. At UHU, 2 days later after the regiment protest, a riot greeted a visiting South Vietnamese diplomat. And after like an hour-long battle, police were just like virtually thrown off campus. Pretty cool victory. In August of 1969, a Gallup poll showed for the first time that a majority of 55% of people were for withdrawal of troops. As well, this was by the time that working class militancy was surging. 1969 was also the year, if people know of Clary O'Shea, a union official, he was jailed for refusing to pay fines, industrial fines. And there was very nearly, there was a huge kind of unofficial strike. Hundreds of thousands of workers protested his jailing. So, yeah. So the peak mobilizations of the anti-war movement were the moratoriums, and there were several of these. The first and the biggest was organized in May 1970. And in the different cities, these were organized by different coalitions. By this time, some figures in the Labor Party, like Labor left MP Jim Cairns, was organizing against the war, also involved some union leaders from the CPA. So on May 8th in 1970, something like 200,000 people took to the streets across the country, possibly up to 100,000 in Melbourne alone. And a huge proportion of the moratorium protesters were students, uni and high school. In Brisbane, there was kind of like several days of action. A UHU student meeting had supported a Revolutionary Socialist Student Alliance proposal that all lectures be devoted to discussing the war on the 6th of May, that a strike and symposium be held on Vietnam on the 7th of May, and then that students would join the march on 8th of May with the aim of building a socialist revolution in Australia to help the people of Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. And on the day, on the 8th of May, building and maritime workers, meat workers, engineering workers are struck, and they were joined by 3,000 UQ students in the 10,000 strong demonstration. And the student revolutionaries were important for helping to shape parts of the terms of debate in the movement. The moderates could only keep some control of the anti-war movement by adopting a lot of the slogans, trying to copy a lot of the tactics of the far left. So, for instance, at a 1,000 strong moratorium conference in Sydney in February in 1971, the CPA had to move to prevent itself from being outflanked from the left. And they proposed "Stop Work to Stop the War" as a slogan for the next march, and called for an immediate and unconditional withdrawal of troops. And previously, the CPA had kind of only raised minimal demands, like stop the bombing. So by the early 1970s, the US and Australian governments had finally seen the writing on the wall, and were going to try to retreat from endless escalation, try and retreat with their tail between their legs, basically. Between 1965 and 1975, the United States and its allies dropped more than 7.5 million tons of bombs on Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, which was double the amount dropped on Europe and Asia in World War II. The West had left at least 4 million dead and millions more disfigured, struck down with cancers in coming years, thanks to the chemical weapons used. So this is kind of like what they had achieved in Vietnam. The McMahon Liberal government announced a withdrawal of troops in early 1971, and the US had withdrawn most ground forces by early 1972. So with the winding down of the war, much of the impetus and momentum was taken out of the anti-war movement. And the focus of students moved to kind of like getting fully rid of conscription. And some of the most infamous actions were kind of happening in this time period, like the 1971 occupation that turned Melbourne Uni Student Union into a draft resistors sanctuary. Hundreds of students participated to kind of like help barricade. There were like four draft resistors who were hiding away inside the union building. And students on motorbikes with flares patrolled the campus. In fact, allegedly students had even got hold of a ship's foghorn to warn of like cops coming onto campus to get the, to come and get the draft resistors. Notoriously the cops bashed their way into the building and didn't find the draft resistors, and they got away to fight another day. And just months later, the cops experienced another humiliating defeat at Sydney Uni. Two cops had jumped in the car and handcuffed themselves to infamous draft resistor Michael Madison. And then the driver of the car just drove it straight into the campus of Sydney Uni, where they just kind of yelled out, "Help, help, I'm a draft resistor." And thousands of students kind of came, some from like, there was just like a neighboring rock concert was happening on the campus, but like thousands of students just surround the car. And don't let the cops go. Bolt cutters, they just kind of make their way through to the car in the middle of this. They unclip, Michael. He's cut free. He just kind of gets away. They scurry him away in the crowd. And, this is a newspaper image of the cops forced to walk off the campus, with their handcuffs dangling from their wrists. Oh, wow. Yeah. So in concert with the resistance of the Vietnamese people and the GI revolts in the army, the anti-war movement had dealt a huge blow to US imperialism. It had exposed the US as not all-powerful and invincible, and this hung over successive US administrations for decades. It made them wary to plunge deep and, you know, go big and go hard on future wars. And I think we have to thank the anti-war movements for being part of that fight that made, you know, gave the US warmongers that so-called Vietnam syndrome. You know, how many lives that saved over the years, I think, is uncountable. A whole generation of people had been transformed, and some of this generation were made left-wing activists for life. Many students entered the protests with apolitical attitudes, not already Marxists, and revolutionary socialists on most campuses numbered just a handful. But the pivotal role a number of daring, dynamic Marxist students could play in deepening and widening the revolt was proven time and again, alongside the factors of administration and police repression and the feeling of general rebellion across the world just kind of spurred even more people into activism. And into the 70s, student politics in general kind of retreated from system change to the personal life and looking inward, worrying about personal autonomy, you know, self-reflection and so on. But UQ was something of an exception, as activism revived in the late 70s to fight the Bjelke-Petersen's government banning of street marches. And the audacious, sometimes silly stunts of students at this time became part of the archetype that lives on, the classic uni student protester, the classic like stereotype of uni students as a rebellious, as a volatile group. For example, just one of the things I read about was like the easy thing to do was like all the registration forms to join the army. They were just like available on shelves at your local post office. So student, you know, pretty easy to do, pretty quick. You just walk in and sign up Santa Claus. You just walk in and register Mickey Mouse, Harold Holt, you know, Robert Menzies. You sign all those people up. I read an account of someone saying he signed up his father's two ferrets to the army. And they were the government dutifully sent the ferrets some call-up notices, some registrations to appear for training. And the rego forms were eventually discreetly tucked away behind our counters. Mm-hmm. We have the 60s generation to thank for creating the stereotype of uni student activists and leaving a legacy of radicalism on campuses across the country. And I think it's important to also say, while the CPA's influence in the labor and the student movements was not broken, it was challenged. And the decade-long rebellion from the mid-60s to the mid-70s did not just help end the murderous war in Vietnam, it also laid the ground for victories for working-class people on a range of fronts. Strike days per year went on to peak in 1974. And between 1969 and 1974, average hourly wage rates for men rose by 98% and for women by 142%. This just gives some scope of the kind of like battles that were being fought and the ways that class struggle had returned to the scene. The Vietnam experience also steered some unions towards social activism for the first time. And one of these was the Builders Laborers Federation, who of course went on to become famous later in the 70s for their environmental actions under the Green Bans. And the Vietnam moratorium tradition also influenced the trade unionists who joined campaigns and took industrial action in the campaign against uranium mining towards the end of the decade and in campaigns against nuclear disarmament. So I think some of these impacts are still being felt by us today in the campaigns against, the nuclear submarines as well.